Hello, I'm Candace Burke, host of Community Spotlight on Gila Members Community Radio, Silver City, New Mexico, Kuru 89.1 FM, and online at gmcr.org. Our purpose is to enhance public awareness of our nonprofit or advocacy organization in Grand County and surrounding area. Today, I am joined by guest Catherine McCarroll. Catherine is on the board of directors of the Grand County chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. The purpose of the ACLU is to protect and advance justice, liberty, equity, as guaranteed by the Constitution of New Mexico and the United States. Welcome to Community Spotlight, Catherine.
Good morning.
Good morning. I hope the introduction was as you had hoped it to be.
Sure.
Well, Catherine, you're here to talk about the Second Chance Bill. This prison reform bill would, quote, ensure that individuals under the age of 18 at the time of their offense have a meaningful opportunity for release. Now, Catherine, tell us all about this bill and what the ACLU is doing to support it.
All right. The Second Chance Bill would give individuals who committed a heinous offense at the time they were under the age of 18, and they were treated as adults. So they were sent to prison for lengthy periods of time. These individuals would be given the opportunity to go before a parole board once they had served 15 years of that sentence. Going before the parole board, they have to show that they have been rehabilitated and have served enough time, have done programs. They also have to show remorse. They usually that takes into consideration the feelings of the victim or victims. They have to have a plan. They have to show that they would be of no harm to the community, that there'd be safety. The plan has to show that they have a place to live, the opportunity to work, sometimes treatment, counseling. Obviously, safety to community is one of the key things the parole board's looking for. If they don't have that all together, they're not going to be released into the community. So there are there's a safety network in place. If they are not paroled at the 15-year mark, they can't go before the parole board for another 5 years. That's written into the bill. I'm not personally keen on that 5-year mark, but that was what was written into the bill. The other part of the bill gets away with life without parole for juveniles. There are 25 other states, and I think the District of Columbia, that has eliminated life without parole for juveniles. So that's half of the country. In New Mexico, a life sentence is considered 30 years. I come from New Hampshire. That life sentences in New Hampshire are considered 18 years.
Wow, that's life a vast sentences difference, isn't it?
A very vast difference.
Yeah.
Life sentences throughout the country vary from, like I said, 18 years to 20 years to 25 years. Now, those are for adults. That's on the adult basis. We're talking about individuals who were under the age of 18 when they committed this offense. So there's a vast difference.
There really is. It's my understanding that where there are 79 current inmates in New Mexico who were juveniles at the time of their sentencing?
I believe that's about right. 75, 79 that are still incarcerated.
Maybe 75,
right now.
Yeah.
This bill would be retroactive too, so that those individuals who are incarcerated would be considered to go before the parole board if they have served or when they have served that 15 years. Some of them have not reached the 15-year mark, but some of them have. And again, they don't necessarily just get out at that time. They have to show that they have reached all these milestones and have done what they need to do so that they would not be a danger to society.
Exactly. I think there's a misunderstanding around that. There's no real free so-called jail pass. They have to demonstrate, right, that they have rehabilitated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I sat on the parole board in New Hampshire for almost 5 years. So I sat on individuals who were up for parole who had been minors when they committed their offenses. And I know exactly what we were looking for at that time. And in a lot of cases where they were coming right from behind, well, we called it the walls, we had them step down. We had individuals go into like a halfway situation for at least 6 months, sometimes up to a year, where they would learn budgeting, get a job in the community, and essentially step down so that they weren't from behind the walls. Most of the time, the facility had already done that. They had already had an individual in a step down type of situation so that they didn't come before us from right behind the walls, that they had already been in a halfway house where they were working and getting treatment on the outside, counseling, where they'd already established a bank account, where some of them had already $5,000 saved up, where they were in the community interacting with other people. So it was pretty safe at that point to release somebody into the community full time because they were already there part of the time successfully.
Catherine, how difficult is it for that individual to find work and housing upon their release? Or is that already in place, like you said? Or
well, it's on their own, it can be difficult. There needs to be reentry programs. And I met someone recently that was part of a reentry program assisting inmates on reentry. And they assist. They help an individual find housing, find jobs. Sometimes people start with part-time jobs that grow into a full-time position, school. Pell grants are still available. They're harder to get. There's other scholarships. Well, now in New Mexico, you can get your education. Most of the time behind the walls, they can get their GED. In some places, they can work on college credits. It depends. The more education, the more successful an individual is going to be. Prison programs really do help. And that's something that the parole board we'll look at is the certificates that people have accomplished in the trades. That can be huge. Oh, yeah. I know an individual, people accomplish carpentry, automotives, upholstery. There's a lot of trade industry that goes on. Printing and press, business cards, things like that. I know they're at one of the prisons. There's a whole print shop. Those are viable trades.
Yeah, they absolutely are, and very much so. And what are some of the obstacles here in New Mexico? What is the ACLU facing in terms of obstacles in passing this bill, especially in lieu of the fact, what did you say, 25 other states, including the District of Columbia, have already passed this bill?
Well, they haven't passed this bill. There are a number of states who have. Those states have eliminated juveniles without life sentences, that half the country. But there are about 10 states who have passed like a second chance bill, including Texas, which is getting slammed for a lot of other things. But yeah, Texas, Utah, there are a number of them that are close by who are providing juveniles that are incarcerated like this for heinous crimes with a second chance. It is certainly one of the items that is on the agenda on a national level to reduce the lengthy sentences, period, not just for juveniles, but for everyone. There's a task force that just released a report on lengthy sentences. What's happening is, even in the last, since 2000, I guess, 5 to 2019 and up, the lengthy sentences have been imposed. They were back in the mid-90s, too. They go in sequences. I mean, and then the prisons get jammed up because there aren't the releases because of the lengthy sentences. And we're at that period of time right now where this prisons are overloaded with people. There's geriatric units in prisons, and there's prisoners who are actually working with other prisoners because they don't have the nursing staff.
I know. So it's like some of these jails are turning into nursing homes, for goodness sakes.
You know? They are. And so these elderly prisoners are not really being well taken care of. Other prisoners are changing their diapers. I mean, they're doing the best they can. And I'm not saying that that's not a, you know, it has to be done. But please, these geriatric prisoners are of little risk to the community at this point. They're only being housed. They could be released on a compassionate release. And there is such a thing. They can and probably should to reduce the population. There's a strain on prison staff. They have difficulty finding prison staff or jail staff, and they can certainly, there could be a reduction there. More programming could be done if there were fewer inmates too. So, I mean, there's a lot that can be done for reform.
Unquestionably, you look at the fact that so many long-term inmates are people of color. The discrimination, you know, race and culture plays a part, you know, a huge part too in how long an inmate stays in too.
These stats definitely say that. And again, there's this, these task forces that they're, the Council on Criminal Justice is a bipartisan task force with people that have come from all different parts of the country, former AGs, former federal appeal justices. I know one of the judges was from a Superior Court justice from New Hampshire. She's great. She was on one of the task forces that did a report early on. They're just, some of them are absolutely brilliant people, but they're also common sense people. They've worked in the field. They know what they're talking about, and they've come together. They put a proposal together of different things that could be done. One was to reduce these long sentences on a national basis. One was to allow courts to take a second look at sentences. Now, this was on a national basis, and their recommendation was to take a second look at sentences, at least at the 15-year mark, for everybody, not just juveniles, everybody that was serving a long sentence, to let the court take a second look at that long, not a parole, because not every state has a parole board. A lot of them have determinate sentences where somebody just serves so much time and then goes immediately on to a probation or parole. They don't go before a board. This national board was saying, let them go back to that court at the 15-year mark. Let the court determine whether they should reconsider the sentence that they imposed on this individual. Let them show the court what they've done and let that court. Now, all the way along, let's not forget the victims either, because they have a voice in this. It's not all about.
Exactly. There are victims in these situations. Yes. So I'm glad you're bringing attention to this. What, tell us a little bit about their rights as victims.
Okay. And this is, if you don't recognize the victim, if you don't have empathy for the victim, none of this matters. And we sit down on the parole board. The victims are allowed to come into the parole, the hearing. They were notified. We had a group that sent out notifications to the victims, and they followed them. If there was a change of address, they made sure that they were up to date on that. They even tracked down where people were and invited them. If they were wary about being in the hearing room, it was taped so they could listen to the tape outside if they needed to, if they didn't want to come into the room. They took all precautions they could to have victim input. They could send a letter in, which would be written and read in the hearing room. Now, that didn't mean that what the victim absolutely wanted would prevail, but their input was given and it was meaningful. In certain cases, we would put restrictions about where an individual could go. I mean, a restriction on county, even if it was that they couldn't travel to a certain place where the victim might live or work or frequent, so that there would be no, especially in a sexual assault type of situation or something like that. We certainly took in what they said and tried to make a reasonable rules around that to protect the victim and to consider reasonably where the inmate was going. I mean, there are some times where the inmate would choose to relocate, period, so that they, and that was a really good decision, so that they wouldn't even be in the same state or same area, that would relocate to another relative's home or something like that. And that was actually encouraged if it was a good good placement, good decision.
Exactly. Now, Catherine, very briefly, there's a story you were sharing with me last weekend about an inmate. What can you say about that?
Okay, well, this is an individual who I kind of met word of mouth. He learned that I had been on a parole board. He's from another state, and he was going up for parole. This individual, who's right in this whole category, had committed a murder when he was 17. He was involved in a gang, one of these national gangs that was a bad one. He and another individual, back alley kind of thing. They both had guns. They were with their own little gang, and then there was another individual with his little posse. And words were exchanged. I think a girl was involved. And so he shot his gun. The other individual, who's quite a few years older, shot his gun. The fellow that I subsequently worked with, his bullet hit the other kid. The other kid succumbed to his injury the following day. And the other kid was 18. Race was definitely involved. So he was charged as an adult. He pled to first degree murder. He did not have competent counsel. I've seen the transcript. I saw the pre-sentence evaluation.
Mm-hmm. First degree murder.
First degree murder. He thought there was a plea bargain that where it would have been essentially like a second degree murder. But that's not what went down. It went down as first degree murder. First degree murder carries mandatory. So it was never, the plea that he thought he had was never reduced to writing. So in the judge even said he'd been sitting on that bench for 16 years and he never saw anybody plead to first degree murder. I mean, nobody does. It was not warranted as a first degree murder. It was the intent wasn't there. I mean, even the police report on that was 2.5 pages long. That was it. That was the investigation. Oh, wow. 2.5 pages.
Wow.
Yeah. There was nothing. There was no forensics. There was nothing. So it was. His family life was disrupted when he was a teenager, but the probation report said it was just wonderful that there were no problems. He, of course, did not admit to any problems. You know, kind of covered for the parents and said everything was good. His parents were the only ones, well, his mother was the only one that testified, you know, on his behalf, which, of course, she's biased, and her testimony lasted no more than a minute. I think an aunt did too, but her testimony was about a minute long. He didn't have anybody that really testified in his behalf at a sentencing hearing, which was didn't appear to be longer than maybe 20 minutes. Judge called him a thug, focused on him not going to school for a week and not listening to his parents. Now, this kid was there for murder. That's what he focused on. So the judge gave him 25 years before he could go up for parole. He thought he was going to get 20 years, but with good time, he would be out in 13. So that's not what happened. He got 25 years. So when he got in touch with me, he was going up for 25 years. That was his first parole date, was 25 years, the 25-year mark. And he had put together his parole plan, and it was great. It was very well written. He had a place to go. He had a job to go to. He had achieved a lot in prison. Now, this is a kid who hadn't gone further than sophomore year, and I don't think he had actually finished sophomore year. His education had been quite disrupted.
Yes.
Family had moved.
And he put so much energy and motivation into his rehabilitation from what you're saying.
Well, okay, he did eventually. The first 10 years, not so much.
Not so much, but eventually.
He did. The first 10 years, he admitted that he was in lockup a lot. He was young and he was only looking at, I'm here for the rest of my life, pretty much. So,
yeah.
Why?
So he felt very powerless in the face of this sentencing. And he was very angry.
Totally. He was. And he admits that he was angry at the beginning. He didn't understand what had happened. That's not what he thought was going to happen. And he really was angry at the whole system. So he just was rebellious and everything. And then finally, he figured out that this isn't working. And he changed things around. He took educational programs. He studied paralegal, so he could help other prisoners. He did. He started writing briefs and things for other prisoners. And he started doing their resumes and helping them when they were going out. And when they came in, he would do an introductory kind of course for when they came in as to what they needed to do. He also took carpentry, took like a carpentry program. He took pretty much whatever was available. Interestingly, he said the programs were kind of contingent on the administration. It differed, okay, this gets political, but it differed on whether there was kind of a Republican in the administration or a Democrat. During when there were more Democrats, there were more programs going on. There was much more available.
Yes, I would imagine.
And the reverse was true when it was an administration. It would filter down and then everything would kind of dry up.
Well, Catherine, as we're getting close to wrapping this up, what's his status now? What's going on with him?
Oh, So he didn't get released at the 25-year mark. They held him back to step down. He had to go into, he was in like a medium max at the time of the 25 year. So he had to go step down into a more medium security type of facility. But he is now out. He is doing what he wanted to do at peer counseling. He just went to a week-long program to get certified. He has been, I think, on four different shows, and he's working with inmates. He has actually been in the same room with the chairman of the parole board and on different committees with him already.
Wow, so that's remarkable.
He just got released in March.
Oh, bravo.
And he's never going to wear dark green again in his life.
I would not. That would be off-putting for me. Orange or dark green? Yeah.
He's bought himself like bright blue. He should be some. And he's quite clothes horse right now. Yeah.
Oh, good for him. Now, very, very quickly, if you could give us some contact information for our listeners.
Okay. One of the places that I would suggest going is Council on Criminal Justice. This is the national group that's been doing a lot of work on like a national crime bill that hopefully will go through this administration. I know they're working on a whole lot of other stuff, but everybody thinks they're not doing anything, and they are. This is Council, CounciloncJ.org.
Okay.
That's where that task force on long sentences, which just came out. Of course, go to ACLU-NM.org.
Okay.
And you'll find a write-up by Denali Wilson about the second chance bill there that she wrote up in February. And hopefully we'll get all kinds of support there. Now, we also have the Silver City chapter of the ACLU, which
is a very, very active one, I might add. A very active chapter.
Yes, we are. And we meet typically on the first Monday of the month. And at the Commons here in Silver City.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. I really appreciate you. Also, another thing I want to add is this will be posted online, the contact information.
Okay. I mean, there's plenty more, but those are a good beginning.
I think so, too. Thank you so much again, Catherine, for being our guest today.
Well, thank you.
Community Spotlight airs every Thursday morning at 10:30 a.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. It is also available online at gmcr.org. You're listening to Community Spotlight on Gila Members Community Radio, Silver City, New Mexico, Kuru 89.1 FM, and online at gmcr.org. I'm Candace Burke. May you be well and happy.